A promise of wealth creation or a tax trap? What's in the Labour Party manifesto? Welcome to Political Fix from the FT with me, George Parker. Coming up, Sir Keir Starmer promises voters a decade of national renewal. So, what's the price tag on that? I'm afraid Lucy Fisher can't be with us today. She's currently on the 19th hole of a golf course in Puglia, no doubt eating tortelloni with Giorgia Meloni at the G7 summit. But I'm joined by a stellar cast to discuss the latest on the Labour manifesto and the state of the election campaign 3 weeks in. Welcome to the FT's Miranda Green.
Hello, George.
And hot-footing it from Manchester, where the Labour manifesto launch took place, is FT politics reporter Rafe Uddin.
Hi, George.
Plus, we're joined on a special occasion by the FT's consumer editor and host of the FT's Money Clinic podcast, Claire Barrett.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, before we start, Rafe, tell us what it's been like on the Labour battle bus. What's the food like and what is the mood like?
Well, it's been a fun 4 days travelling around with the Labour Party. I think we've probably stopped in about 6 or 7 towns, sometimes towns where we probably didn't need to stop in, but tracking Keir Starmer as he makes various different visits, visiting primary schools, visiting technical colleges, engaging with apprentices and young children as he sets out his mission for the election and government. What's the snack situation on the bus, you ask?
That's the key thing.
Well, very bad coffee, but fantastic snacks, multi-packs of kettle chips and plenty of extra chewing gum with Labour-adorned tables.
Now, I think it's useful to point out this is not the same as the battle buses that, Miranda, you and I have been on in the past, where normally the leader of the party would be on the bus with the journalists, right, at the back in a sort of suite where you'd occasionally be ushered in to do a brief interview between stops. It doesn't sound like that, does it?
No, I think it's all more hyper-controlled. In the chaotic old days that we remember fondly, George, there was always the chance that somebody would wander to the back of the bus, share a cup of tea and blurt something out, which is what the journalists lived for and the aides lived in fear of.
It does sound much more controlled today. Well, look, let's start with the Labour Party and the launch of the party's manifesto in Manchester on Thursday. Keir Starmer said Labour was the party of wealth creation, but at the same time, he announced several new taxes on wealthy people. Now, Miranda, how do the politics of that work?
So it's interesting, this, because clearly the whole approach to this election is, as we know, one of caution in terms of Labour not wanting to screw up its enormous polling lead and also not wanting to kind of frighten the horses about what it might do, even with a very, very large majority that the polls indicate it might get. And so the party was expected to not produce any surprises this week in the manifesto. Indeed, there aren't surprises. But I think what has surprised people slightly is actually the kind of overall tone. So you flagged up wealth creation, but there's also quite a strong tone of sort of social justice and even class politics, arguably, in there. So the wealth creation, we've got to get growth back in the economy, we want to be the party that does business with business, is kind of balanced with we're going for, you know, almost righting the wrongs, the burning injustices that Theresa May referred to on her first day in Downing Street in terms of lack of opportunities and redistribution. There was a lot of talk about redistribution and trying to redefine it. Obviously, it was launched in Manchester. Levelling up is the unfinished mission of the Boris Johnson government. There was that sort of more traditional Labour approach, I thought.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because up until now, it's almost been easy to forget that this is actually a centre-left party standing for election. But as election day approaches and the Labour lead remains rock solid at about 20 points, you get the impression that Keir Starmer's more willing to talk a bit more about that. Now, Rafe, you were there for the launch. The general vibe of the manifesto, I think, was supposed to be mainly about reassurance. There were no rabbits out of the hat, as Keir Starmer pointed out. Did it feel a bit flat?
I mean, I don't think it felt particularly flat in terms of this is the first occasion where he pulls together all this string that they've been trailing for months, if not weeks, into a coherent message, launched from the cooperative headquarters in Manchester. As Miranda says, there's an emphasis on the party's centre-left credentials. here is the headquarters of an organisation that champions the values of this party. The manifesto is written in a sweepy way that focuses on, well, the prose reads as more centre-left than some of Keir's interviews. But in terms of the actual sort of ability to pull rabbit out of that, well, he said, you know, it's not a pantomime. If you want that, head over to Clacton and go see Nigel Farage.
Yeah. And what's the mood like in the party at the moment? The people we speak to, I think it's, they quietly confident, to put it mildly, but you know, increasingly confident, it's fair to say, isn't it?
I think so. I think there were lots of smiles as they sort of thought, well, the manifesto has been launched without much problems. There was a protest, but they're used to that now.
It played into his hands, didn't it? So sort of, we're no longer a party of process, we're a party of government. It was almost like he might have planted the heckler in the hall.
Well, I believe the heckler walked in with all the journalists. But as you sort of say, it does play into this argument that, you know, they believe that the party has changed since its time under Jeremy Corbyn, and he's steered the ship through that period. And there is an air of confidence, and there's also an air of, well, we better not mess it up in the next 3 weeks.
Mm. No, he has been lucky with his hecklers, thinking back to the last party conference where he ended up being sprinkled with glitter, which certainly seems to help him.
It did. All of these interventions help him, because then he can do the kind of workmanlike. I mean, I thought the decision for him to stand there in his shirt sleeves again, because it actually worked for him after the glitter bomb.
Yeah.
To repeat that trick was clever. I'm interested in this whole emphasis on renewal and this idea of, you know, give us two terms, a 10-year programme for national renewal, because it also, again, this sort of emphasis on, you know, our centre-left heritage as a party for Labour. It kind of makes you think of those successful pitches of the past, you know, 1945, 1997, but also the 60s, you know, and Harold Wilson, the white heat of technology. Labour seems to do well when it at least creates some sort of mood that the country can change and can change together. And I think that's what they were trying to create. But I think it was so interesting. I know in what you wrote in response to it, George, you picked up this quote from Jeremy Hunt, warning the electorate about Labour's instincts. And I think it's going to be really interesting over the next week or so whether the Tories can find any sort of attack that picks up on some of this to spook parts of the electorate, or whether Labour is so far ahead that this is a done deal.
So, Claire, we're going to come on to that now with you, and you understand money, I think. fair to say. We want to talk about Labour's tax plans, as Miranda was just alluding to there. Now, in the manifesto, they've ruled out increases in four big taxes: national insurance, income tax, VAT, and also corporation tax. Collectively, they amount, I think, to about 75% of all the Exchequer's revenues. So they box themselves in. So what happens if they need to raise more money in government?
Well, they're not upping the rates of income tax, of course, George, but neither are they ending this financial freeze that the Conservative Party's put into place on the thresholds at which these taxes start to apply. So, I mean, in reality, whoever wins this election, if you get a pay rise, you start to move up that pay scale, then more and more of your pay is going to be siphoned off into paying more income tax. And this stands to raise billions of pounds by the end of the next parliament. One projection I've seen today is that an extra 3 million people could be paying the higher rates of income tax, that's 40% tax, by 2029. Now, it's not just tipping into that tax bracket. It's not just income tax that you're paying. It's also affecting the amount of interest that you can earn tax-free on your savings. If you receive any dividends from your investment, the rate of tax that you'll pay on that, capital gains tax rates as well, linked to the sort of taxpayer you are. So there is this slow creep of dragging more people into higher bands. But aside from that, lots of focus from the financial services industry on what Labour hasn't said it will definitively rule out. Now, on the pensions point of view, they've quietly dropped plans to reintroduce the lifetime allowance, which would be a very, very political thing to have done. Wouldn't have helped highly paid doctors who they're trying to retain in the NHS. Obviously, their big target is to improve health outcomes and fund the NHS better. So they've backed away from that, but they haven't specifically ruled out changing pension tax relief. Now, of course, if you're a higher rate taxpayer, then you get higher rate tax relief on your pensions.
There's a lot of money in that, isn't there?
And it's very, very skewed, that system, towards rewarding the higher earners with the most tax relief for the pension contributions that they're making. Now, what I did notice is that Labour is going to have a pensions review. Now, it's been quite sketchy in the language that it's used in the manifesto document, but quite rightly, it wants to review how pensions are working. The basic problem is, George, none of us are paying enough in to funding our future retirement. That could potentially include the future of the state pension and the triple lock much further into the future. They've committed to the triple lock, of course, which is hugely expensive, getting the pensioner vote in, haven't gone as far as the Tories. But ultimately, all of these promises are pretty unsustainable. So there are levers that they could pull in the future. But like Miranda was saying, if they're going for this two-term promise, a long-term vision, they need to give the people who are listening to this podcast the long-term confidence to plan their own personal finances properly.
And to reassure the business community and wealth creators that Britain will be a good place to be under a Labour government. And just on the pension tax relief, it's important to point out that Rachel Reeves in the past, not the very distant past, said that she thought it was a good idea to cut the higher rate pension tax relief system. That is not Labour policy at the moment. They have no plans to do it. Another thing that she has refused to rule out now, but has previously advocated, is increasing taxes on unearned income, capital gains tax. Mm. Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I mean, this is a trickier area. Of course, if you're a hedge fund manager, then the plans to change the treatment of carried interest. So instead of charging you like a capital gains tax type rate on income from an investment, to actually charge income tax, which for most higher earners would be 45%. That's a big change for a small group of people. But nevertheless, it is a change that has, you know, spiritual ramifications, you could say, for the finance community. It shows that Labour is prepared to intervene where they think there is an unfair advantage to certain groups of people within the tax system. And of course, capital gains tax is horrifically complicated. It's very hard for people to actually understand how much they have to pay when they get a capital gains tax bill, because there's so much going on with the system. There's been a review from the late lamented Office of Tax Simplification under the current government that recommended making all kinds of changes, not just to capital gains tax, but how it interacts with inheritance tax, that other great political bugbear. So whether we will see more changes in future, I mean, they're the obvious revenue-raising levers to pull.
When you've excluded all the main ones.
And as me and Rafe were saying before the recording, there's also a question mark over how much revenue Labour might be able to raise from some of the other measures it's put into place, like clamping down on tax evasion or indeed taxing non-doms more. One of the emails I had in my inbox this afternoon from a finance guy was saying, well, lots of the non-doms have already left.
Well, there's a whole lot of hope attached to this manifesto, I think, in the public finances space, including the idea that growth will come to the rescue. But if you look at the Institute for Fiscal Studies forecasts on this, leaving aside the fact that, as you say, Claire, Labour are committed to sticking to the Tory plans on freezing thresholds and allowances, they say that that still amounts to real terms annual cuts for unprotected departments of about 3.5% a year, a whole of about £20 billion. Now, if the Labour Party decided it wanted to fill that hole, or if growth doesn't come through, what do you think, Miranda? Do you think they will have to pull the tax lever that Keir Starmer says he doesn't want to pull?
Well, we should probably have a conversation, shouldn't we, about our wonderful former colleague at the FT, Beth Rigby, and the moment that Rafe and I were discussing before we came on air, when she had to turn to the audience in the Sky interview with Keir Starmer and explain the form of words that he was using when he said, we have no plans to raise those taxes. And Beth actually turned to explain and to say, this is politician speak, you know, for we're leaving the door slightly ajar. And that's the question here, isn't it, Claire? You know, Claire's gone through for us all the options that might be there. The insult in politics used to be, oh, you think there's a magic money tree. It's almost as if the political class has decided to use the idea of economic growth as a magic money tree that's suddenly going to appear on July the 5th. You know, obviously we all have to hope that an incoming government finds ways to ramp up economic growth in the economy, because on that depends the entire plan to, you know, rescue the public services and all the rest of it. But that's not going to happen quickly. That's not going to happen overnight. And a lot of it also, I went to a very interesting conference this week, a huge new study on immigration to the UK, as well as public attitudes to immigration. A lot of the existing growth is actually dependent on these incredibly high rates of non-EU immigration. So you've got a kind of political conundrum, even if you want to sustain such anemic growth that there is at the moment, let alone promote more. I mean, I think what will be really interesting is to see whether in the first few weeks and months of a Labour government, they can find enough of these things that don't cost the exchequer, but that release investment into the economy, such as their big plans on house building and planning, infrastructure,
planning
for
reform and stuff. Yeah. I mean, there's always a possibility, of course, that growth comes back stronger than some people think. I mean, Nick McPherson, the former Treasury Permanent Secretary, said he thinks that this is a good election to win and that growth will come to the rescue. And it's possible that people will look at the country with fresh eyes, with a new government, and that they'll look around the world, where do they want to invest? Do they want to invest in France, where there's a new round of political uncertainty? Do they want to invest in America, where, again, some political uncertainty? You know,
look at good prospects.
Well, you never know.
Comparison.
But I think that's a really important point, actually, because, you know, people slightly take the mickey, don't they, of Rachel Reeve saying stability would be a change. Mm. But it's true, you know, to get away from the chaotic impressions that have put off inward investment would be a big win.
But given how much effort, Rafe, that has been put in by the Labour Party and Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves in particular to woo business leaders, do you think there would be a sense of betrayal if Labour comes in, looks at the books, oh my goodness, it's much worse than we thought, and comes after them and their pensions potentially and their capital gains?
Well, I guess it's what they will try to do is go in and potentially do a spending review at some point. They haven't apparently decided what kind of spending review they'll do, whether they'll do a temporary sort of short period and then do a more extended period, maybe 3-4 years once they're in office. So they are hedging on this. There's always the possibility that it could be slightly better than expected, and that would be encouraging for them when they come into government. What they haven't spelt out, and they've yet to sort of detail to any of the reporters in the lobby or those who were asking questions at the manifesto launch, is what they expect growth to be from all the various initiatives that they're going to put forward, whether it's the Green Prosperity Plan or the National Wealth Fund. They haven't spelt out what it's going to look like. What they did suggest was, well, when they were last in government, they averaged about 2.1% in growth versus 1.7% in growth under the Conservatives for the past 14 years. Mm. So, what, 0.4 percentage?
Yeah, the financial crash came in the way of those two episodes. I think, to be fair to the Conservatives. Now, Claire, you're here. I can't resist the possibility here to talk to you about national insurance. We talked a bit about the Conservative Party manifesto launch earlier in the week, but it's intriguing to me that national insurance has been put front and centre of the Conservative election campaign. We all remember that Rishi Sunak actually wanted to increase national insurance, a tax he now says he's aspiring to abolish. And one of the things in the Tory manifesto is the idea of removing completely the main rate of national insurance paid by the self-employed by April 2029. If my memory serves me correct, this was a rate he wanted to put up after the COVID crisis. Is that correct? So what's going on here?
I was very surprised to see this overture towards the self-employed in the Conservative manifesto, because during the pandemic, I was one of many journalists who campaigned fiercely for the self-employed to be recognised by the furlough scheme. Because at first, there was absolutely no support in place for self-employed people. Then some was brought in, but it was more limited. And then large groups of people were still excluded from that if they were a self-employed company director, for example. And, you know, lots of businesses failed. These are the backbone of British business, you know, people who are entrepreneurial, starting firms, employing people. And the groups that I speak to, their members still feel incredibly betrayed by the Conservatives from that period. So to see this SOP, Tiedemann, we're going to abolish Class 4 national insurance payments. National insurance is a horrifically complicated tax, like so many British taxes. I mean, that was very, very unexpected. It's been costed. It's going to cost them several billion pounds a year. Will it be enough to make that community want to vote for the party again? I mean, that's the real killer here. The Liberal Democrat manifesto, interestingly, went much further on the issues of taxes for self-employed people. IR35 This is the treatment of the tax of contractors, people who aren't technically employees of a company, but the revenue might think they are. All kinds of really big cases in the news with, you know, TV presenters. Adrian Childs is one that's going through court. It's taken 10 years and it still hasn't reached a resolution. The Liberal Democrats would do a lot more on resolving IR35 and other thorny problems relating to the loan charge affecting contractors and the whole way that the gig economy operates, because there's around 5 million people who are freelancing in some capacity in the British economy. The labour market needs it. You know, we need the flexibility. Employers want it, but everyone is terrified of putting a foot wrong, not paying the right taxes and retrospectively ending up in trouble. And that's really something that has deeply affected self-employed people in the last parliament.
Interesting. And one of the reasons why, of course, chancellors quite like national insurance is you can put it up because people don't really understand what it is. But
yes.
Equally, the reverse seems to be happening to the Conservatives. They keep cutting it and no one seems to give them any credit. Now, let's be brutally honest about this. Looking at the opinion polls, it seems to me we probably shouldn't waste too much time studying the fine print of the Conservative Party manifesto. Miranda, what do you make of the new Tory tactic, which we first reported earlier in the week, of the Conservatives urging people to vote for them so that they can provide a strong opposition to Keir Starmer's government? In other words, to avoid a Labour supermajority, as Grant Shapps put it. It's a bit early to throw in the towel, isn't it?
It's extraordinary. I have literally never heard anything like it in all the general elections that I've taken an interest in, which is very many at this point, being quite long in the tooth. And to do so, you know, just before halfway through a six-week campaign, I mean, what are they going to say? Are they going to keep this up for the next 3 weeks in the desperate hope that some, you know, former Tory voters come back on side in fear of a kind of socialist one-party state? Is extremely peculiar. I did think there was a flavour of this, though, already before they, you know, took this tack. I remember hearing an interview with James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, in which he said very early on in the first week of the campaign, well, I'm going to continue fighting right up until the last minute, which is what you usually hear a party that's really on the skid saying, you know, the day before polling day. And so I did think, you know, they must be looking at private polling in a lot of those seats and thinking that they're an absolute goner. It'll be interesting to see whether it works. I think there actually might be some mileage in this for some of their former voters, particularly if you do combine it, as we've been discussing, with some of the kind of flavour and atmosphere of the political vision behind the Labour plan. You know, if you could sort of scare a sort of few percentage of people back into the Tory column, you know, at this point, if you're staring death in the face and you're thinking, my goodness, we might be down to fewer than 100 MPs, which I think is not an unreasonable prospect for the Tories, you know, you might be into the game of marginal gains.
Well, yeah.
You know, and that sort of scare tactic could be a marginal gain.
Well, also particularly aimed at voters thinking of voting for Reform UK, who I think the Tory private polling suggests might be concerned about the prospects of an unrestrained Labour government. So it's obviously aimed at those, but an incredibly defensive strategy. And as you say, quite early on in the campaign. Now, Rafe, you were watching the Sky News debate in Grimsby on Wednesday night. What did you make of the performance by Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak?
Keir Starmer was responding to lots of questions about his time in service of the cabinet under Jeremy Corbyn, the left-wing leader of the party. And he was pressed on this point about running on a manifesto that was much more heavy on the public spending and borrowing than his current message. And he said, well, you know, the party has changed. Corbyn's no longer a member. I didn't expect us to win.
Either. That was an extraordinary line, wasn't it? I endorsed Jeremy Corbyn as a future prime minister because I knew he'd never be prime minister. I mean, what an extraordinary thing to say.
And it is an extraordinary thing to say. And then he sort of goes on to say, well, you know, when I became Labour leader on a raft of pledges that were much more sort of left-wing, well, things have changed. I've changed the party to...
Uncharitable people might say that he says what he needs to say at any given time, which might make you regard what he said about the Labour manifesto in that, potentially, in that, if you are being sceptical about this. Now, what do you make of Rishi Sunak's performance there, Rafe? I mean, he looked to me like not just a deflated politician, but almost a defeated politician.
Well, I think what he was having to do is arrive at that debate and defend a 14-year record in government, most of which he wasn't really around for. he tried to move it towards going, well, look at my record in office. Look at the past 18 months. Net migration has fallen while I've been in office and in charge of this party. But people are not going to quickly forget the mini budget of Liz Truss. They're not going to forget the COVID period under Boris Johnson and Partygate. And they're also not going to forget the quite rough waves of the aftermath of the 2016 referendum. All of that is baggage he had to carry into that debate. So actually, it was quite tricky for him to come out of it swinging, really.
I'd like to just make a little plug here for a couple of articles we've run the FT this week. We've done a kind of audit of 14 years of Conservative rule.
I enjoyed reading that.
With some amazing charts by our colleagues in the stats department and some quite interesting interviews. We interviewed George Osborne, Michael Gove. I also spoke to Nick Clegg, you don't hear from very often these days, talking about how the coalition government is the most forgotten government in history, not least because his own party doesn't want to admit it ever happened. So it's quite entertaining. But anyway, I would, if you have a chance, I would advise you to read that. I've put free links to those in the show notes. Miranda, we watching the Sky debates, the broadcast. What did you make of Rishi Sunak's demeanour?
Well, it's sort of listening to Rafe's excellent description of it there. It's almost as if sort of Sunak is a kind of reverse King Canute, because, you know, the Tory tide is going out. There is nothing he can do to stop it. And he has just sort of stood there at the edge, you know, with the water going out, and he's left stranded on the shore. And as you say, he's not entirely a kind of clean skin anyway as a prime minister, because, you know, he was Boris Johnson's chancellor, even though he, you know, did resign towards the end as part of the attempt to bring Johnson down. You know, he himself is a strong Brexiter, so he, you know, still wants to argue that there are Brexit benefits.
Not as often as he used to.
Not as often as he used to. Nobody does as often as they used to. And he hasn't actually, during his 18 months in power, he really didn't manage to distinguish this time of his premiership from what has gone before. He tried to sort of have it both ways by disavowing the bad things, you know, and trying to claim that he was the change candidate. Do you remember the 5 minutes that he said he tried to claim he was the change candidate? That didn't work. And so, you know, he has many faults as a prime minister, but the whole 14 years is not his fault, but he is being punished for it inevitably by the electorate.
Well, George, I'm afraid I'm going to rule myself out of commenting on the Sky News debate. As a personal finance expert, I save money by not subscribing to Sky.
What a bit like the Prime Minister, in fact, or his family, at least when he was growing up. OK, well, that's almost all we've got time for today. Miranda, what are you going to be looking out for in the next week of the campaign? We've reached the halfway point. What do you think is coming down the track?
Well, there's a long way to go still, isn't there, George? And I can't help but feeling that although we've had lots of kind of drama already, that can't be it for the next 3 weeks. And I wonder whether some of the sort of slight pre-election honeymoon gloss on the opposition parties, you know, there might be some grumpy Fleet Street editors somewhere saying, you know, find me something wrong with either Keir Starmer's team or even, you know, Ed Davey, who seems to be having a brilliant campaign so far. There hasn't been that much scrutiny. And I'm just wondering whether there's a row to come.
Claire, what are your thoughts?
I think we're going to see lots more rows over the minutiae of tax policy. It's the obvious attack card for the Tory party to say that Labour has secret backdoor plans to raise taxes. And as we've discussed, the wording in the manifesto didn't completely rule out tweaks and changes that might happen in future. So anything that would really plunge a knife into the heart of wealthy Tory voters, things like pension tax relief, inheritance tax, future reforms to the ISA regime, capital gains tax, any kind of rumours or worry that can be whipped up. Because there is so much worry at the moment. Lots of FT readers who are contacting me are saying, should I take my 25% tax-free lump sum from my pension now? I don't need it, but I'm worried that a future Labour government might take it away. You know, that's quite typical of the thoughts that are going through the mind of a lot of the electorate. And on Labour's part, I think we'll get an awful lot of reassurance, not just from Sir Keir Starmer, but from Rachel Reeves as well, the Chancellor, and reassurance to the business community, who she's been courting so effectively for the last year.
Well, hopefully we'll be hearing a bit more from Rachel Reeves in the pages of the FT and online, of course, over the next few days.
Yeah.
Rafe, what are you looking forward to in the campaign? You're probably looking forward to drinking that beer that's in front of you.
Well, so I've committed to not drinking for the campaign, which feels like a mistake.
I know, me too, Rafe. It's awful, isn't it? I don't know why I said this to myself. I'm sorry.
But I'm, well, quite tempted. We've got one of 100 Beff Rigg beers from the Sky debate that were brewed for the Sky News debate. And I'm tempted to open that up in the coming days and sit back and just and relax for a little bit. I will be sort of probably travelling up to the northeast and parts of the country like Boston and Skegness, where Reform UK might be making advancements to actually see what the temperature's like for that party, which is hoping to replace the Conservatives as the main opposition. Because that's really, I think, where tensions might inflame in the next few weeks.
I totally agree with that.
George, what do you think is going to happen next week?
Well, I think Rafe's going to drink that bottle of beer. And I should just say that it's called Beth Rigg beer. Just a tribute I think we should pay to our former FT colleague, Beth Rigby. If anyone listening, so many of our listeners were watching that Sky exchange, I thought she did a fantastic job. Just the exact correct mix of, you know, sounding like a human being, but asking some really deep, penetrating questions.
Unfortunately, Beth not standing for Prime Minister.
Alas, not. So what else am I looking forward to? I'm looking forward to seeing a bit more of Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrat leader, in water-related situations. I mean, there's people calling him Centre Park Dad, aren't they? But actually, it's really interesting. Some people say it's frivolous, you know, these are serious times. It seems to me, you were alluding to this earlier, Miranda, that he's running a blinder of a campaign. And there have been some opinion polls picking that up. I know that the YouGov poll was taken, I think, around the time when the Lib Dem manifesto was launched, so they were getting a bit more publicity than you would expect. But it put the Lib Dems up to 14 or 15 points, I think. Now, that's probably a blip. You can't base things on one poll. But just anecdotally, talking to people, particularly younger people, they've sort of seemed to have achieved something there with someone that no one had ever heard of, rather boring-looking middle-aged bloke, and actually made the campaign seem fun.
Yeah, and also actually catapulted some important issues into the campaign that otherwise would have been ignored, such as social care.
And the video video that the Lib Dems made of
really
Ed Davey
moving video
looking after
his family,
disabled son, really impressive. So listen, that's it for this episode of the FT's Political Fix. We'll be back on Tuesday with Lucy Fisher in the host chair again for a campaign catch-up. Do check out the free links we've put in the show notes. There are articles we're making available on subjects discussed in this episode. There's also a link there to Stephen Bush's award-winning Inside Politics newsletter, and you'll get 30 days free. Political Fix was presented by me, George Parker, and produced by Audrey Tinlin. Manuela Saragossa is the executive producer. Original music and sound engineering by Breen Turner. Studio engineering by Andrew Georgiadis and Rod Fitzgerald. And Cheryl Brumley is the FT's global head of audio. Thanks for joining us.
Presented by BlackRock.
Want to know what's happening in the markets? On The Bid, a podcast from BlackRock, we break down what's happening in the world of investing.
We see in so many of the developed economies, people just don't have the adequacy of savings to live in retirement in dignity, specifically in the United States.
And explore the forces changing the economy and finance.
We've never had such fantastic alignment around public policy and technological innovation that we see in infrastructure right now.
Subscribe to The Bid wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is brought to you by Aura. 2024 has seen a surge in high-profile data breaches, raising serious concerns about the security of personal information. This past summer, National Public Data reported a breach potentially affecting every American. That's why we're thrilled to partner with Aura. Aura is a complete online safety toolkit, which includes a variety of other features to keep you safe online, including a VPN for secure browsing, data broker opt-out to stop companies from selling your personal information, a password manager to help you create and store strong passwords, and more. For a limited time, Aura is offering our listeners a 14-day trial plus a check of your data to see if your personal information has been leaked online, all for free when you visit aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety to sign up for a 14-day free trial and start protecting you and your loved ones. That's aura.com/safety. Certain terms apply, so be sure to check the site for details.